Dina Gold had a grandmother who told her fairy tales. Grandmother Nellie's stories were about faraway places and the riches that could be found there. Except she was talking about Berlin, where she claimed the family had owned a huge block of land and an expensive building. We'll get that back and then we'll all be rich, Grandmother Nellie would say. Where others might have assumed these were the words of a fantasist, Dina Gold, investigative reporter, took them at face value, and she discovered many years later that her grandmother had been right. Dina is in Australia as a guest of the Jewish Writers Festival, which is on this weekend. Dina, welcome very much to Life Matters.
Well, thank you very much, Ellen. Nice to be with you.
You're speaking to me from Perth, so I'm very glad that the jet lag means that you are awake at this hour of the morning.
Yes, wide awake now.
You write that Grandma Nellie would take you to a patisserie opposite Harrods for coffee and cakes that she could barely afford, and she'd tell you stories of her grand lifestyle in pre-war Berlin. I've got you as a little girl with wide eyes. What did she say?
Yes. My granny Nellie, her favourite thing was to take me to this patisserie directly opposite Harrods, and she would fill my head with these stories of her grand lifestyle that she lived in the 1920s and 30s. She had married into a very prosperous family. Her husband's father, whose name was Victor Wolf, had built up the family fur business, which became one of the largest fur businesses in Germany before the war. It was tremendously successful, and it had representatives all over the world. I mean, in London and Copenhagen, even in Melbourne. And this fur business managed to provide the family with a fantastic lifestyle. They had a huge park with a villa on it in Wannsee, which is a very upmarket suburb. And in fact, it was just down the road to where many years later the Wannsee conference was held to plan the extermination of the Jews. And Nellie had nannies for her three children, my mother being the eldest. They had cooks. They had gardeners. They had a chauffeur who drove the family Mercedes and who lived on the grounds. And she would fill my head with these wonderful stories.
And she would talk to you about this building, this grand yes. building that your yes. family had owned.
Well, she would claim to me that the family had owned this building, and she would say to me, when the Berlin Wall falls, we'll be rich, we'll get this building back. Now, this building was where she said the family fur business operated from. But after the war, it had fallen just the wrong side of the Berlin Wall, two blocks, in fact, from Checkpoint Charlie. So it was in the Soviet sector, and you couldn't launch a claim to get anything back from the Soviets.
She didn't have an address. She didn't have any documentation. Your mother, a very, very practical woman, what was her view of her mother's claims about this building?
My mother said to me, Nellie is unreliable, and she was actually fairly unreliable, and she was a fantasist. Don't listen to your granny. Don't look back in life. Always, always look forward. What is the point of looking backwards? You can't live your life like that. Forget it.
And that's interesting that Aviva would say that, because her life's experience had taught her that, hadn't it? Her life's
yes.
experience had said to her,
yes.
always forwards, don't look back, it's too much.
That's right, that's right. She had grown up, obviously, in pre-war Berlin. She went to school there. She experienced the anti-Semitism, the little girls at school dancing around her. They put her on the chair. She was the only little Jewish girl in the school, and they would sing When Jewish Blood Spurts from the Sword, and all this nonsense. And in 1933, her father had the foresight. He said, I'm not bringing up my children like this. And he took his wife and three children to the British Mandate of Palestine, and they lost all their money. And my mother gave up this life. Obviously, she had no choice. And at the age of 14, she was sent to Britain to go to school on her own. So the rest of the family were all in the British Mandate, and she had to bring herself up. And then the war broke out, and she became a nurse, and she nursed all through the Blitz in London, and she had a tough life. So, you know, fantasizing about what might be, what could be, she had no time for any of that.
So why didn't you listen to your mother? Because, you know, you describe in writing this book, you say this is a quest for justice, but you're anguished about it because while you lost family your immediate family survived the Holocaust. They escaped. Yes. Why was it important for you to find lost possessions when the Jewish community and your own family had been overwhelmed by lost lives?
Yes. For me, I think it was a story. You know, you and I are both journalists, so we know what a good story is. And I felt that if there had been an injustice, I had to do something to put it right. And also, I was tremendously intrigued. This was Granny Nelly, and she had died in 1977. She'd filled my head with these stories, but she died leaving me no address, no photographs, absolutely nothing. I had no documents at all. And yet I was haunted by her stories. And I felt that in honor of her memory, I should at least find out. And of course, I put it behind me. I got married. I went to university. I had children. I was working as a journalist at the BBC. And for all these years after she died, I put it out of my mind. And then in 1989, the Berlin Wall fell. And I remember distinctly watching the news and seeing all these East Berliners shouting, Wir wollen raus, we want out. They wanted out of East Berlin. They wanted to go to the West. And they were chipping away at the wall. And I remember saying to my husband, you know, watching this, I remember what my granny said to me. She claimed there was a building in Berlin. I don't know. I don't know anything about this. And he said to me, well, you ought to just look into it. And that's what I did.
My guest is Dina Gold, author of Stolen Legacy, Nazi Theft and the Quest for Justice. She writes, you write in your book that the Nazis deprived the Jews of their dignity, their rights and their possessions, and then ultimately their lives. So what you were looking at was the systemic way in which they stripped the Jews of their dignity, their rights and their possessions. So, right, you're at the very beginning. You're intrigued. The wall has come down. You turn to Aviva and you say, Mummy, what do you remember? What do you remember of Berlin? Yeah. I love the story that Grandfather Wolf had a big business in nice furs and including in Melbourne. My grandmother probably bought them. She often went to Melbourne for furs. But Grandfather Wolf could have sold her fake furs. He turned hamster hair into fake mink. What an amazing fellow. What does Aviva remember of the building and the furs?
My mother didn't remember much, but she did have one very distinct memory. And as a little girl, maybe 5 years old, she was taken as a big treat in the chauffeur-driven Mercedes with her father and her grandfather to a big building. And she remembered going in and seeing piles and piles of pelts. And her father would say, you can jump on the rabbits, but don't you go jumping on the sable or the mink. And that was a vivid memory, and she could tell me about that, but she didn't really remember anything much more. She was little.
You find the first clue when you visit Israel. You find a long-lost cousin, Lior, another journalist, good bit of luck, and he has that most wonderful thing, the old suitcase full of family memorabilia. You open it up. What's inside?
Well, there were lots of old photos of people that we didn't know. We had not a clue. There was no labelling on them. But we rummaged through all these papers. And then we found an old, singed, yellowed piece of paper. And it had an address on it. And it was H. Wolf, Krausenstrasse 1718. Now, H. Wolf was the name of my grandfather, my mother's father, and his father, my great-great-grandfather, who'd founded the business in 1850. So here we had a letterhead with an address. And I thought, could that be the building? I knew it wasn't their home because it wasn't in Wannsee.
Krausenstrasse. There's no Google at this stage. Krausenstrasse. How do you go about finding Krausenstrasse?
I was, as luck would have it, I was working at the BBC and I was working on the first combined German elections. After the wall came down, Germany reunited, and in 1990 they had elections. And I was covering the elections for the BBC, and we had a German researcher, and I said to him, could you possibly help me? See if you can find out anything. And it didn't take him long. He found an old 1920s business directory. And there was H. Wolf Krausenstrasse. And he sent me this copy of this paper, and I thought, this is it. I think we found the building.
Right. Krausenstrasse, 1718, Berlin. Take me to the moment on the freezing day, December 1990. Yes. You have a business directory. You have a letterhead. You have Dina Gold, not one shred of evidence. And you're standing outside a six-story government building. What's your plan? Yes.
Well, I'd taken a few days leave, and I flew from Bonn after covering the elections, and I flew to Berlin, and I got in a taxi, and I gave the address. The taxi driver, and we passed Checkpoint Charlie, and we passed the wall with all the graffiti on, and he pulled up outside this building, and it was starting to snow, and I had this red duffel coat on and a woolly hat, and I get out, and there are flags flying outside, and I got somebody to take a photograph of me. And then I thought, well, what do I do now? Either I get back in the taxi and I go back to the hotel, or I take things further. And I thought, well, I've come all this way. What can they do to me? They can either throw me out for trespassing, or they can listen to what I've got to say. So I marched in across the marble floor to the entrance. There was a lady sitting in a glass booth knitting. And I said to her, I'd like to speak to whoever's in charge. And she looked completely blankly at me and picked up the phone. And a few minutes later, a portly gentleman came into the reception. He said, well, what do you want? And I said, I've come to claim my family's building. And he laughed at me. Well, he didn't laugh for too long.
What did you say that suddenly made Herr Munch stop laughing?
I pulled out of my pocket the only piece of evidence that I actually had on me, which was this advert in the business directory. And he said to me, oh, this building has been owned by the German railways for decades. And I said, I think not. Have a look at this. And I shoved this in front of him and he paled. And I said, H. Wolf, that's my grandfather's name. And he went, oh, you'd better come in. And he ushered me through into the canteen and he said, you sit here. I'm going to phone my head office, which at that time was in Bonn. So I sat there for 20 minutes. When he came back, he was a changed man. He came over and he said to me, I've just spoken to somebody in head office. You're right. They've been waiting for this to happen. But the person I spoke to didn't know if anybody had survived the war. Tell me your story. And I then spent the most extraordinary half an hour telling him the family story. At the end of which he said to me, you must get this building back for your mother. And I then confided in him that actually I had zero documentary evidence. I couldn't prove anything. And he said to me something which was unbelievably brave, I think, for an East German official in 1990. He said to me, the documents exist. You go out there and you find them, but they do exist.
How could he be so certain? How could he be so certain?
Strange. I think somebody in Bonn, whoever he'd spoken to, had said, we have a file. And he also said to me something which was very, very curious. He said, you know, all the people, there were hundreds of them working in that building. He said, it has been known amongst us here as the Wolf Building, but nobody really knew why. Well, Wolf was the family surname. So I said, well, I'll tell you why. And it's because that's my mother's maiden name.
And that's why he paled when you said,
yes,
Grandfather Wolf.
He knew, yes.
Before we move on with the story, he said to you, we've been waiting. We've been waiting for this. Why did they wait?
It's extraordinary.
Why didn't they come and find you?
Oh, well, I don't think they could. I mean, these were East Germans. Why would they come looking? I don't think that people in Germany went looking for Jews who'd lost property. That's the pity of it all.
Yeah, perversely, it was the Soviet record keeping that was of great assistance to you. So here you have the Russians who come into Berlin, they rape, they loot, but they make file notes, detailed file notes about the uncertainty of the ownership of Krausenstrasse 1718. And they say, it may have been given over to the Nazis under duress by your Uncle Fritz, who'd stayed behind in Berlin.
Yes.
Why did Uncle Fritz stay and what became of him?
Well, my grandfather, my mother's father's brother, his younger brother, Fritz, refused to leave Germany. He said, I am a German. I am not leaving this country. Despite everything that was going on, he remained. He tried to run the business. By that point, when the Nazis took over, nobody was buying furs. So they gave up the fur business, and they were running this building as an office block for other Jewish textile businesses to rent offices in. And Fritz tried to manage the business, the family affairs as best he could. I'm afraid he came to a very sad end. He had the opportunity to leave. My grandfather had got him a visa to go to French-controlled Syria, but nope, he would not leave. And in the course of my investigations, the Germans, being inveterate hoarders of documents, I found what had happened to him. I found the transport for him to Auschwitz in 1943, which upset my mother greatly, of course, because she remembered her uncle vividly and she loved him greatly. And what happened was that eventually in 1937, the mortgage was foreclosed on, even though the mortgage was being paid. They had a perfectly standard mortgage with an insurance company, and it was foreclosed on. And instead of the building being put up for auction to the highest bidder, it was handed straight over to the Reichsbahn, Hitler's railways.
And here we have two modern echoes that resonate, that make this very much not just your family history and an historical injustice, but resonate in the modern day. The Victoria Insurance Company, they held the mortgage over the building. So they were working with the Nazis. That's like banks in Australia working with a genocidal government to strip people with mortgages of their homes. What is the legacy of that company in Germany today, and what have you discovered about them?
Oh, well, the Victoria Insurance Company is still a huge insurance company. Actually, it's now owned by something called Ergo, which is itself owned by Munich Re, an international reinsurance company. And they were busy foreclosing on properties all over Berlin. They were at the behest of the Nazis. I mean, Albert Speer was redesigning central Berlin, and they needed to clear out these properties so that he could, first of all, in our building, the Reichsbahn took it over because they had to house their architects to enact the building designs of Albert Speer. So that was what our building was used for. But in terms of other Jewish properties, they were all being foreclosed on. By 1937, Jews had no rights.
You also discovered that the Victoria Insurance Company had been involved in insuring parts of Auschwitz.
Yeah, it's a very sordid tale, I'm afraid. There were consortia set up of various insurance companies that got together, and they would take insurances for various concentration camps. And I have discovered that the Victoria was part of a consortium which was insuring SS-owned workshops in Auschwitz. This is true, yes, I have the documents.
And this resonates today because there is a stipend at Mannheim University that was funded way back by the Victoria Insurance Company. Why does that matter?
Well, I think it's rather shocking that the Victoria Insurance Company now has a foundation named in honour of the chairman of the Victoria. He was the chairman during and after the war. And there's an established foundation at the university in his name. This man, who I discovered an awful lot about what he was up to during the war, it's not a particularly pretty story. But in 1953, he was awarded Germany's highest civilian honor. And he has a foundation in his honor. So quite frankly, I think there are resonances of what happened even up to today.
You obviously had to prove that your mother, Aviva, was the rightful heir of the building, so you had to prove the family line. Authorities can be very pernickety about these details, Dina. Yeah. I remember myself having a silly comparison, but I had to demonstrate some years ago that my grandmother was indeed dead. She was born in 1900, and I was asked for her death certificate in 2012 when she would have been 112 years old. But that pales in comparison to the death certificate you were asked to. What did they want to see to prove this?
I can understand from a legal perspective, they had to make sure that, the family had owned the building rather than just rented it. They had to show, I had to show the line of inheritance, because anybody can come along and say, well, I own this building and hand it back. So you have to show who is the legal inheritor. And I had to show that this was a Nazi-driven seizure. It wasn't a case where the family couldn't pay the mortgage. I had to prove that they were targeted.
How do you do that 50 years later?
Ah, well, it is possible. First of all, the fact that the building wasn't put up for auction. This shows intent. It was collusion. But also, the Germans, incredibly, have all these documents. So in the land registry, I managed to get hold of, to chart the paperwork of what had happened to the building. And I found that in this building, after Victor died, was left to his wife, Lucy, and I got hold of her will. I got birth, death, marriage certificates, wills, and I could chart the line of inheritance.
All down to Fritz. Fritz Wolf, who had stayed behind in Berlin, was listed as verschollen, missing, which is code for genocidal murder in the German records. Why were you so offended when the German authorities proposed a date of death for a death certificate that they would produce of December 31, 1945?
Yes, well, I wasn't going to accept that. Actually, I said to my mother, there's no way we accept it. They said, we will issue a death certificate for him, but we will date it end of 1945. And I said, no way, under no circumstances.
Why not?
Because I knew that he was on a transport in 1943, and I knew that at the age of 52, there was no way he had survived and come out and maybe died peacefully in his bed at the end of 1945. That would absolve them of all responsibility for what happened to him. And we said, no, we won't accept that. You must give us a death certificate that makes more sense, and that you have responsibility for what happened, that the Germans had murdered him, the Nazis had murdered him. And in the end, they capitulated, and we did not get a death certificate for the end of 1945.
And the Germans had that as an official policy. No, if you're verschollen, if you're Jewish and verschollen, we just say December 31, 1945.
Well, they then changed the law. And now they give a death certificate if you've disappeared in the camps for the end of the war.
It took you 5 years to achieve an £8 million restitution for the building. What difference did that make to your mother's life, given the dislocation and the suffering and the loss that she had endured before and after the war?
Well, my mother had a brother and a sister and then a half-brother, and I wasn't the inheritor. I did this for my mother. And it did help her a lot. She'd always had a great fear of going into an old people's home in her old age, and that she didn't have to do. She could remain in her own home and have a living carer. But she didn't change her ways. My mother was never ostentatious. She wasn't interested in jewelry and fine clothes or any of that. She did manage to have some nice holidays with my father, and she helped her grandchildren. She paid for their education. And I think it gave her peace of mind. That's all.
And what would Granny have said, Granny Nelly?
Oh, she'd have said, I told you. I was right. I wasn't making it up. And sadly, of course, she never saw what I managed to achieve. But she would have been thrilled, absolutely thrilled.
What a tale. Dina, thank you so much for telling me about it at such an early hour in the morning.
Well, nice to join you. Thank you.
I hope someone buys the film rights. That was Dina Gold, author of Stolen Legacy, Nazi Theft, and The Quest for Justice for Krausenstrasse 1718, Berlin. And she's in Australia as a guest of the Sydney Jewish Writers Festival, where she will be this weekend.
Do you guys have Barramundi here?
This is Mike and Timothy,
Potato Scallops,
the unlikely hosts of a new RN podcast. It's called The Real Thing.
Oh, my, too perfect, too hot.
Stories.
Intimate stories, scenes, characters, places.
Born of Australia.
We're heading out into the corners to find the real Australia.
The Real Thing.
That's us.
Subscribe now.